Welcome to today's program titled International Trade Secret and Non-Compete Law Update. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, type your question, and click send. This presentation has been prepared by Saifar Shaw, LLP, for international purposes, informational purposes only, and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion of any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Juan Lee, Ming Henderson, Justine Turnbull, and Daniel Hart. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. This is Ming Henderson. We're very excited to present this webinar today. We're delighted that you have joined us today. The first slide gives you the aims for today, and we're going to get cracking on, starting with the topics that we'll be covering during this session. We're going to take you on a journey across the world, Europe, APAC region, and a stop in the US as well. The first thing we'll be looking at are what are the key rules for protections in Europe and how does that differ from the US. We'll then move on to focusing on the UK, France, and Australia with a bit more in-depth analysis of these various countries. Then my colleague and partner, Wang Li, will be covering the latest developments in China. We will then give you an overview of the new European legislation on trade secret protections and what are things you should be looking for. And last but not least, we'll be covering the top tips for multinationals and give you some practical pointers on what you should be aware of and what you should be mindful of. So, as mentioned, we are going to first look at the key rules for non-compete and non-disclosure agreements for Europe. But my colleague and partner, Dan Hart, will run you through some of the US aspects of these restricted covenants as a starting point so that you can compare these with Europe, as many of you are based in the US.
Thank you, Ming. As an initial matter, it should be noted that U.S. law about non-compete agreements is principally a matter of state law rather than federal law. There's no U.S. federal statute on non-compete agreements, and so each of the 50 states has its own approach. In some states, that's a matter of statutory law, and in others, it's governed by common law. And so in the next few minutes, I'm going to give some overarching observations about U.S. law in this area, but I do so with the big caveat that the applicable law can and does differ dramatically from state to state. A first important distinction to note about U.S. law is the at-will nature of most employment relationships in the U.S. There's no requirement in any state that employers provide their employees with employment contracts for any particular duration. And so, as those who practice in the U.S. are aware, the vast majority of employees here don't have individually negotiated employment contracts and rather are considered to be at-will employees. as a result, typically non-disclosure and non-compete covenants are not going to be contained in a full-fledged employment agreement. More often, we see them in the U.S. in standalone non-disclosure agreements, which I'm going to refer to as NDAs for short. U.S. employers also will frequently include these types of provisions in incentive compensation agreements, such as a stock option plan or other deferred compensation plans. And for the small group of U.S. employees who do have individually negotiated employment contracts, similar covenants are usually included in those agreements. Now, because so many employees in the U.S. are employees at will, consideration is a very big issue here. Is it enough simply to provide employees with at-will employment, or do employers need to provide something else of value to bind employees to non-compete and non-disclosure covenants? And the states take different approaches to that question. In some states, at-will employment is enough, in others it's not. The same issue applies to terminations in the U.S. Generally, either party can terminate an at-will employment relationship at any time, as long as the reason for terminating the relationship is not an illegal one, for example, a discriminatory or a retaliatory reason. And so that begs the question, if an employer can terminate an at-will employee, can the employer also enforce a non-compete against the terminated employee? And here again, the states take different approaches. Some states say yes, and other states say no. An even bigger issue in the U.S. is whether an employer can enforce a true non-compete covenant at all. And by non-compete covenant, I'm referring here specifically to a covenant that prohibits an employee from being employed by a competitor for a certain period of time, as opposed to a covenant that simply limits the ability of the employee to compete, for example, by soliciting certain customers or soliciting employees. And here again, the states take vastly different approaches. In the vast majority of states, non-compete covenants are permitted as long as they are reasonably limited in time, geography, and scope. But a handful of states, and most notably California, prohibit true non-compete covenants altogether. And finally, in the U.S., employers generally are free to simply withdraw or waive non-compete covenants, or any other restricted covenants for that matter, if they choose not to enforce them against a specific employee. Now, one caveat to that is notable. If an employer selectively enforces its non-compete covenants, it may have more difficulty getting a court to enforce its covenants when it really matters. But employers might decide not to enforce their non-competes against a specific employee for a variety of reasons. And for the most part, that's okay. With that, I'm going to hand it back over to Ming to discuss Europe by contrast.
Thank you, Dan. The contrasts are very stark in some aspects of employment law between Europe and the U.S., but there are also some aspects that are not dissimilar. Now, in terms of stark differences, at-will employment does not exist in Europe. It's not a concept that is that employers are familiar with in Europe, and I think that pretty much outside the U.S., at-will employment does not exist. But in terms of non-compete, what it means is the non-compete covenants will be, in the main, in employment contracts. They will be usually part of the employment contract, but they can also be regulated by collective bargaining agreements. If you have a regulation in a collective bargaining agreement, you, however, do still need to have a specific clause in the employment contract, or separate agreement if you want to, but it has to be signed by the employee. In terms of consideration, it is always important to have some consideration, but in addition, in Europe, you are sometimes required to make a payment for the duration of the non-compete. It's not the case in all countries, but it is the case in a lot of Western countries, and there's a lot of case law there that defines what is adequate consideration, and it's obviously important to make that payment, because otherwise the non-compete will be null and void. In terms of withdrawal, it's important to understand that whereas there in the US there may be limited restrictions for employers to withdraw or waive a non-compete, in Europe there are often very important restrictions. We'll look into countries a bit further later on, but if you just look at Germany, if you want to withdraw a non-compete clause in a contract, you need to give an advance 12 months notice. In France, there will be also some very restrictive time limits for withdrawing the clause. Finally, I think that what is really very different between the US and Europe is that in Europe, the clauses are potentially valid, whereas in the US, as Dan said, you know, they could be potentially invalid in some of the states. There is a common idea that the non-compete should be should be reasonable, it should be justified by business interest, and of course what we'll see across Europe is that there's not a blanket rule that applies in for all the countries, but there is a very different interpretation in each country as to how that would be interpreted. So moving on to the key principles for enforceability, the first box at the top deals with the duration, the geography, and the activity. Now, what is a reasonable duration is going to be very different depending on the country. For example, in Italy, a non-compete for 3 years could be valid, and even 5 years for executives. In France and Germany, you'd usually look at a non-compete for 12 months, potentially 2 years. In the UK, however, it's going to be much shorter, and in Austria, it's going to be 1 year. So again, Europe isn't a federal state, but it looks as if each jurisdiction has a different interpretation of what is reasonable. An interesting point is that if the territory is very limited, so the geography of non-compete is limited, you can sometimes have an extension of time. So it's the overall balance that of the clause that's going to be considered. The non-compete has to be justified in view of the employee's role. You know, you can't have a non-compete for every employee. It has to be carefully tailored to the role of the employee. You have to look at what the employee's responsibilities are, whether they are senior enough, whether there are legitimate interests to defend. Another point, if we look at the blue box at the bottom there, is that some countries will require that the non-compete be in local language. It's the same rules as for employment contracts, in fact. In Belgium, notably, the agreements need to be in French and Dutch. In France, it needs to be in French. The UK are not so fussy about the language, because obviously English language applies. You may find that in certain types of dismissals, the non-competes would potentially be invalidated. So that means that you need to be very careful in terms of the way and the circumstances in which the employment contract is terminated. And then finally, the question of the consideration on entry and during the non-compete is going to be a key element. Consideration at the time the employment contract is, the non-compete is entered into the employment contract, but also at the time where the non-compete is enforced. Again, there's going to be a lot of differences between the various countries, but this is just a summary of the key principles. Now, moving on to the payments, we thought it would be useful to have a bit more in-depth view of the payments, because what you really want to know is whether you can enforce the non-compete at the end of the day, and one of the key components is the payments. And it's probably one of the most controversial aspects because the employer wants to make sure that the clause is enforceable, but they don't want to be paying more than is strictly required for the clause to be enforceable. You'll see that in the majority of countries, so for example, Germany, Spain, Italy, the payment and France as well, the non-compete is required to be accompanied by some form of compensation. It's either going to be a percentage of the salary or it's going to be based on the average salary of the last 12 months. But what's important is that you need to look at what is sufficient consideration. It's possible in some circumstances to have the payments apportioned during the term of the employment contract. This is the case, for example, in Spain, where you can say if your employment contract, the employee receives 100,000 euros a year, you can say, well, 20% of that payment is apportioned towards the non-compete. It's possible, provided the appropriate drafting is inserted in the clause. It's not possible in France, for example. In the UK, you don't need to have any particular payment. What is key is the consideration at the time of entering the non-compete, but it's not required during the actual duration of the non-compete itself. I mentioned the waiver of the non-compete and mentioned Germany. We're going to talk about France later on. I think what is really important is that the waiver will need to happen at the point of termination, except Germany, of course, where you need to give yourself 12 months period unless the employer agrees to that waiver. And then if you've got an agreement, then you don't need to comply with the 12 months. But you can imagine that if you're considering that at time of termination, it may not be very practical. But if you do want to have a waiver, exercise a waiver, you need to make sure that in the actual clause that that right has been reserved so that you have this contractual entitlement. Now, moving on to the circumstances in which the termination may impact post-termination non-competes. This table is interesting just to show that the countries in Europe are very different, and they are just to give you some alarm bells in terms of what you need to be aware of at the time of termination. So if we look at Austria, you'll see that if the termination is unfair or if the there is constructive discharge due to the employer's actions or if the employer breaches the contractual notice provisions, then potentially the non-compete clause that was in the employment contract will be invalidated. That means that if the circumstances of the termination are such that the employee can argue that termination was unfair, then the non-compete will also be unenforceable. The UK just has one across the bottom. It's the circumstances where, for example, the employer didn't comply with its notice or was in breach of the employment contract, then again, the non-compete can be invalidated. You'll note that France doesn't have any crosses here, but that doesn't mean that non-competes are always enforceable. There are some restrictions, as we will see later on. Now, let's look at the key principles of non-competes and non-disclosure agreements in some selected countries. We've got an overview of the UK, France, and Australia. And again, I think it's important to understand that what is reasonable in one country and what may seem to be obvious in one country may not necessarily be obvious in another country. A bit like what Dan was mentioning in the US, what may work in a state may not work in another state. So this table here is just a summary of what are the similarities and differences in each country. If we look at France, if we look in the UK in the first box and on the left, you'll see that the non-compete has to be narrowly focused on the employee's own personal activities. Now, what that means is, for example, if you have an employee who is going to be has a very broad responsibility, a worldwide responsibility, then it is perfectly acceptable to have a non-compete that covers potentially all of Europe or a global territory. However, the duration will usually be quite short, maybe 3 to 6 months. But that can be in addition to a garden leave, which can be, again, 3 to 6 months. The difference is that the garden leave is going to be fully paid. It's like a notice period that is unserved, whereas the non-compete, the employee doesn't have to be paid. By contrast, if you look at France, now there's going to be a longer duration, and again, it will be focused as well on the role of the employee, but the duration it can be reasonably considered to be much longer. The question is sometimes arises is, well, if an employee is based in France and is covering all of Western Europe, can you potentially say that the non-compete covers all of Europe? Now, it may be very reasonable because, for example, if you're looking at activities like IT, where territory is actually not that relevant, you may have a legitimate business interest for that, but it's going to be pretty difficult for you to argue that if, for example, the payment is not a strong consideration. And then on the third box, Justine Turnbull can maybe cover that element regarding Australia.
Thank you, Ming. Happy to do that. In Australia, the position around non-compete agreements is very similar to the UK, and we draw generally our law from there. The driver in Australia is the public policy here, which favours everyone's ability to work and earn a living, and the public policy that's in favour of competition. So on their face, non-compete clauses are going to be unenforceable unless you can go to a court and show that they are necessary and reasonable to protect a legitimate business interest. So that then becomes the focus. What is the legitimate business interest? It's usually confidential information or some specific trade secret or a customer or client connection or a connection with staff. And so that legitimate interest, business interest, is capable of protection if it can be shown to exist, to be a proprietary interest of the employer. And then once that's shown, it's for the employer to show that the period of the restraint and the geography or the territory in which it's going to operate is appropriate. So, for example, if we're going to have a six-month non-compete restraint to prevent a salesperson from poaching the clients of the business they're departing, then what we would need to show is that it would take us at least 6 months to rebuild those relationships. So that's broadly the position in Australia, Ming.
Thank you, Justine. Now, moving on to our journey, as I was mentioning earlier, just an overview of the recent developments in non-competes in the UK. The general trend is that seems to be a tendency that there's a more lenient approach from the courts towards employers. So basically, the right of employers to enforce non-compete agreements seem to be slightly broader given the recent case law. The nature of non-compete agreements is that they are very much based on a case-by-case basis that there is an approach that is very fact-driven. Therefore, I wouldn't encourage you to be more cautious than you may have been in the past, because it's probably hard to draw some hard principles from a set of circumstances. And what ultimately you really want to ensure is that you are going to be able to enforce your clauses. And as you know, case law changes year on year, so you still need to be cautious. But there is some positive developments. We talked about the fact that you had to have show that the non-compete clause is reasonable given the particular circumstances. Now, there is a recent case law, PAT Systems versus Nelly, that established that the reasonableness needs to be judged at the time the covenant was entered into. So that's a good reminder that the covenant won't work if it was unreasonable at the time the employee's intended role was signed. What it means is that even if the employee was subsequently promoted, if at the time he entered into the original non-compete, the non-compete clause was not reasonable, then you won't be able to enforce it. It also means that what you need to do is monitor the non-compete as the career of the employee develops. Another interesting case law that arises in Iman Sadiq versus Blue Bay, at the top of our slide here, deferred remuneration as a potential restraint of trade. The question was, well, if an employee was given equity, so a share scheme, on the condition that he complies with his non-compete agreement, was that potentially a restraint of trade in the circumstances where the employee breached his non-compete and was therefore not allowed to receive his deferred remuneration, the share scheme? There was a bit of debate in that case law as to whether this was a penalty clause. The court ruled that no, it wasn't a penalty clause. It was perfectly valid. It was just a condition of the equity being considered. So what's interesting here is that, and we've often seen that with our clients, is, for example, in the context of an acquisition, you've got a key employee, you want to give them a share scheme, but you also want to make sure that they don't compete. So what's important here is that you'll need to make sure that if you've got an employee that's based in the UK, even if you've got a share scheme that's under the laws of Delaware, you still need to make sure that that non-compete is compliant with English law, that it's reasonable, that it's balanced, that there is a business interest. But if there is a commercial situation, for example, if the share scheme is actually quite important, it seems that the courts accept that the non-compete can be attached to it and can be quite broad. So it's positive because you are then in a situation where you can have a non-compete and a share scheme. You just and the fact that there was a deferred remuneration means the court does consider that commercial situation, but you do still need to comply with English law. Now the two other interesting developments are with respect to the length of the covenants. I was saying earlier that 3 to 6 months is what you would usually go for. There is, however, a case that says that it can be up to 12 months. We do have a case where 2 years is actually being considered as excessive. So that means that, you know, you can potentially go up to 12 months, but if you want to be cautious, probably try and stay below that. And then finally, the situation where there was a variation, reaffirmation of the covenants, it's possible to have variations and reaffirmation of covenants, but you just need to make sure that there was a proper acceptance by the employee. Now, a very different situation in France. The focus is, as previously mentioned, very much on the financial compensation. There's been some interesting case law recently regarding, well, how much does that financial compensation need to be? Those of you that have operations in France will know that there are some collective bargaining agreements that define the compensation, so sometimes 50%, 40% of the average salary. Then that's fine in the sense that that gives you an idea of what is the minimum that you need to pay your employee during the non-compete. But there's a lot of collective bargaining agreements that don't have any rules regarding restricted covenants. And in that case, well, it's up to the employer to define what is the reasonable compensation and circumstances. Looking at case law, it looks as if, well, pretty much 30% is the minimum that you would be considering. Most of the time, you would go for 40% of salary during the monthly salary during the entire period. The case law has ruled that if the salary is just a base salary, that is potentially insufficient. So you would need to be looking at the salary, including variable pay, so including commission, including any bonuses during the period, and that would be the benchmark for the percentage applied for the compensation. The other interesting case law was in a situation where the employment contract said, well, if you resign, the compensation will be half of what you would get in case of termination by the employer. So the idea was that, well, if the employee resigns, then the employee would be voluntarily leaving the company and therefore would be entitled to only 50% of the non-compete compensation. The High Court ruled that that was not lawful and that the employee need to receive the same compensation whether the termination was by the employer or whether it was by the employee. And the rationale for that was that the employee has the freedom to work wherever he wishes and therefore should not be restricted by the non-compete from moving from role to role. It's quite a surprising decision in my view, but very important to know so that you don't become too creative when drafting a non-compete clause. I think that's really what I wanted to say about France. So we can now maybe move on to Australia with Justine's input.
Yes, certainly. Thank you, Ming. So again, the position in Australia generally is very similar to the United Kingdom, and there's quite a detailed slide there. But generally, like the United Kingdom, we don't have at-will employment as in the US. And unlike Europe, we don't have very specific legislation around restraints of trade other than in one state, and I'll come to that in a minute. But as I mentioned before, the focus in Australia is on determining what are the legitimate business interests that need protection. And they are usually trade secrets, confidential information, and customer connection or staff connection. The question then becomes, what do you need to do to protect those interests? Do you need to have a non-compete? Or commonly in Australia, there will be, together with non-competes, non-solicitation and non-dealing obligations. Or there may be those non-solicitation, non-poaching, non-dealing obligations instead of non-compete obligations. But the considerations for the various types of provision are the same. And that means we have to look at the business interest that needs protection, and then the specific role of the relevant employee and what it is that they have that we need to protect and what's appropriate in protecting those. So what's the length of the company business cycle? How long will it take us to recruit someone into the role? Where is the business located? Can we access it easily by technology, for example, or are the relationships very personal and built up over time? So they're the general considerations that we have in Australia. It's worth noting also that post-employment obligations are generally only imposed out here on senior executives or very key employees. I've not seen a restraint in a collective bargaining agreement, for example. So that's one another distinguishing factor. Around the payment issue that Ming has been talking about, especially in Europe, technically, from a technical legal perspective in Australia, making a payment for a restraint won't assist with legal enforceability. But obviously, from a very practical perspective, if you're going to pay someone to sit out of an industry or a trade, then it's more likely that they will comply with those non-compete obligations if they're receiving a payment for that. So at a very practical level, payments are good, they're increasingly common. They are usually just a continuation of the base salary for the period of the restraint, or they are sometimes, and perhaps increasingly commonly, they might be linked to the vesting of a long-term incentive or the payment of an annual bonus. So payments are there, they're common, they're even expected in some industries like financial services. But from a technical legal perspective, they don't actually aid the legal enforceability. The one thing is that is a little bit different out here is in New South Wales, which is probably the main business state in Australia and where Sydney is located, for those of you who don't do business out here. But in New South Wales, we have legislation which effectively allows a court in considering a non-compete to redraft it so that it reflects what it considers is reasonable and necessary to protect the business interest that's been proven to exist in the court. So that's a very interesting power of the court out here. Usually any redrafting is tinkering at the edges. It might be reducing a period of a restraint or the geographical application of the restraint. But the court does have the power to do that. As to the duration of restraint in Australia, like some of the European jurisdictions and the United Kingdom, what's enforceable is going to be very, very specific to the business circumstances. But if I was to give a general perspective, I would say that a six-month non-compete is considered quite long. 3 months might be more reasonable, depending on the role. But 6 months would be, you know, you'd be doing well to get 6 months, other than in a very specific situation, for example, where we have a founder of a business or where we have a sale of business context where we're tying, you know, key employees into the business to maintain its value. In that sale of business context, we can get restraints, non-compete restraints, being enforceable for 2, 3, or even up to 5 years. But if you've got your general executive or key employee who is leaving their employment, 6 months is usual, and up to 12 months is getting more difficult to enforce. So that's the general position in Australia. The next slide just talks about some recent developments in Australia, and I've been fortunate enough to be involved in the first two of these developments. The first is garden leave, and Ming referred to that earlier, but I'll just explain it so that everybody is clear. In the common law jurisdictions, garden leave is a period of notice of termination of employment when an employee isn't required to work or is only required to perform very, very limited duties. Now, effectively, during a garden leave period, an employee is not permitted to go and work for a competitor because they remain employed by the original employer. So the courts in Australia see that as an effective non-compete obligation. And so when they're determining the reasonableness of a non-compete obligation that is to run after the employment ends, they will have regard to the period when the employee was in the garden prior to termination. And that's what happened in the case of Tullett Prebon and Mr. Purcell. And that case was part of litigation that went across Asia and the UK as part of a bit of a talent war between interdealer brokers in the early 2000s. But the Supreme Court in New South Wales said in that case that a six-month restraint or non-compete period for Mr. Purcell was appropriate, but that that period had occurred during his garden leave when he was still employed by Tullett Prebon but unable to go and work for anybody else. So that's an interesting development out here. A second development of note in Australia, although it's always been a technical possibility, is the point around waiver. If employers out here want to enforce a non-compete obligation, they have to act very, very quickly and go straight to a court for an order. They can't wait to see which customers go over to the new employer or which trade secrets or confidential information are divulged. It's incumbent on the original employer to act very, very quickly to approach a court to enforce a non-compete obligation. And if they don't, as happened in this case when Fairfax, one of our major local media company, newspaper publisher, sought to restrain one of its news radio executives from going to a competitor, then the delay in seeking that enforcement of the non-compete meant that the court wasn't prepared to act for the benefit of the newspaper publisher. So that's something to keep in mind out here, especially if you are acting in respect of an Australian business from a foreign jurisdiction with time zones, with other things on your plate. You might take a couple of days to look at an issue out here as it relates to a non-compete, and that can effectively be fatal. The third development I wanted to note in Australia, and it's a very recent one, relates to the nature of the restriction that's imposed on the employee. So in this case, the employee was prohibited in the non-compete provision from working in any capacity for the competitor. Now, the court in this case thought that that went too far. That was not reasonable. So when you're drafting restraint provisions that are going to apply in Australia, it's very, very important to have specific regard to the role the employee occupies in your business and to limit their non-compete to that sort of a role in any competitor business. So they're the main developments I wanted to mention that are happening in Australia. And we're now going to move on and talk about confidentiality and trade secrets in the various jurisdictions and just how in the absence of an NDA, as Dan referred to earlier, so that's a non-disclosure agreement, we would call it a confidentiality agreement in Australia. But in the absence of such an agreement, how do we protect trade secrets and confidential information? In Australia, employees have common law duties, so they're duties that arise not in the written terms of employment, but they just arise from the pure nature of the employee-employer relationship. And there is a duty that will prevent an employee, while employed, from disclosing confidential information, trade secrets, intellectual property during their employment. But after the employment ends, only trade secrets are protected. So it's only trade secrets that employees are prevented from disclosing. There's also specific corporations legislation in Australia that limits an employee's ability while employed to disclose their employer's confidential information. And also, rather than a non-disclosure agreement or a specific confidentiality agreement, it's very common in Australian employment agreements, which are usually written for senior or key employees, to contain specific obligations around the use and disclosure of confidential information and around the use and disclosure of intellectual property, which would include what are known commonly offshore from Australia as trade secrets. So that's the position in Australia, and I'll hand over to Dan now to advise about the position in the USA. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. And the U.S. position is quite similar to Australia's, which I think is probably not surprising, given that both countries have a common law tradition. In the U.S., during the employment relationship, employees have a common law, or in some states, a statutory duty not to use or disclose their employer's confidential information, regardless of whether or not that information rises to the level of a trade secret. That's simply a part of the employee's duty of loyalty to the employer. But after the employment relationship ends, the former employee's obligations are greatly diminished. Former employees are prohibited from using or disclosing trade secrets, which are defined by statute in the vast majority of the states and by common law in a couple of states. But if the employer wants to protect run-of-the-mill information that doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret and the employment relationship is over, then at that point they have to have an NDA because the law is not going to impose obligations other than as a matter of contract. And I'll hand it over to Wan Li to talk about the approach in China.
Thank you, Ben. China, I think, is slightly different from the other jurisdiction. We don't have a sort of a case law. Everything based on the black letter laws, and under the Chinese law, they have defined the trade secret, and so without the non-disclosures agreement, trade secret will be protected both during and after the employment. However, confidential information beyond the definitions of a trade secret may not be protected either during or after the employment. So it is fundamental important in China that any employee may be able to get access to confidential information. It will be prudent, or it is also, I think it's very important to have a non-disclosure agreement put in place. Now I think it's hand over to Ming.
Yes, thank you very much, Wang Li. Yeah, just very briefly on Europe. It's not dissimilar to Australia and the US in terms of what are the obligations during the employment contract, so the employee having a duty of loyalty, having the duty to comply with the interests of the company during his employment. Now, after the end of the employment contract, absent any agreement, only trade secrets are protected after the employment. It's true, however, that the employee in some European countries has a duty not to complete unlawfully against his former employer, and it may be that sometimes using trade secrets falls within that scope. There's an interesting case law in France that says that although trade secrets are protected, know-how belongs to the employee. The employee who has developed some skills with his former employer, who has acquired knowledge that it doesn't that is not trade secret, can use that knowledge and take it on to his new employer. So I think that the recommendation for all the countries is probably that indeed you need to have some proper clauses in the employment contract or as part of a separate agreement to ensure protection after the term of the contract. And I think the next slide is going to be covered by Dan on the non-disclosure agreements overview.
Thank you, Ming.
Yes.
Let me get that. All right.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
Sure. Well, I mentioned earlier that in the U.S., most non-compete and non-disclosure covenants are in standalone NDAs. And a typical NDA in the U.S. has several different covenants that are all intended to work in tandem. You know, most obviously would be a covenant not to disclose, as an NDA would indicate. And typically that's going to include non-disclosure of both confidential information and trade secrets. Typically that's not going to have a time limit to it, except in a small handful of states that require some time limitations for those types of provisions. There's typically also going to be a covenant requiring the employee to return company property. And then there's also typically going to be other covenants in the same agreement, depending on what state the employee is in and what's permitted. There may or may not be a covenant prohibiting solicitation of employees. There may or may not be a covenant prohibiting solicitation of customers, which is going to be enforceable in some states and not enforceable in others. And there may or may not be a true non-compete covenant. The latter of these three kinds of covenants, the non-solicitation of employees and customers and the true non-compete, typically are going to have a time limit associated with them. I think probably the time limits in the U.S. are a little bit longer than what we see typically in the U.K. and Australia. 2 years is not completely unusual. Between a year and 2 years is probably the norm, I would say. Depending on the state, the agreement might set out some basis for consideration other than continued at-will employment. Perhaps most importantly for this discussion, a typical U.S. NDA will often include a mandatory choice of law and forum selection clause. This can be the state where the employee worked for the employer, but that's not necessarily the case. Many employers prefer to take advantage of favorable law in a jurisdiction with which the company has some reasonable connection, such as the state where it's incorporated or where it has its principal place of business. This strategy can help limit the risk that a company will have to enforce its agreements in a variety of different fora that may have unfavorable law. It's especially true of employers with a national or international presence. But you should be aware that the enforceability of these types of clauses does vary pretty dramatically from state to state. Some states will freely enforce such provisions. Others will not enforce them if doing so would violate the state's own public policy on non-compete agreements, or in this case also non-disclosure agreements. And again, the states are going to vary widely and how bullish they are in allowing employers to enforce these kinds of covenants. And I'll hand it back off to Ming to discuss how these concepts play out in Europe by comparison.
Thank you, Dan. Well, by comparison, I think that to summarize, in Europe, the restrictions that we've heard earlier on non-compete do not apply for non-disclosure agreements. The key considerations are that NDAs are sometimes part of the employment contract, sometimes they are part of a separate agreement, and what we've also seen is sometimes they are part of a specific project. Those of you that deal with M&A deals will know that it's not uncommon to get all the employees involved in a particular transaction to sign a separate NDA. I guess it doesn't matter whether it's at company or group level. What's important is the definitions in the agreement, and that needs to be carefully tailored. You have to make sure that the duties of the employee and the commercial environment are taken into consideration. You need to consider what could be potential consequences of breaching the NDA. You see very often the right to obtain damages, the right to recover some penalties. You sometimes need to go through a court to enforce such penalties, and a court may consider the penalties are excessive, but it's quite useful to have that kind of wording in the non-disclosure agreements to just give yourself some leverage as an employer. The question of when the confidentiality may be lost is quite important, because what we try and do with non-disclosure agreements is that although we recognize that when the information becomes public, we ensure that if the information has become public as a result of a breach of another employee or of that particular employee, then the employee isn't released from his duties. So again, that's sort of a very careful tailoring of the clause. In terms of the practical aspects, and that's probably what we find is sometimes forgotten, you may have the best NDA clause in the world, but if you don't actually ensure that you get the documents back from employees, that the data is returned, that the equipment is returned at the time of termination, then you'll find that you have some practical issues with enforcing that confidentiality clause. We've had situations from some clients where the employee was left with the laptop for several weeks and forgotten, and the laptop was then passed on to a number of employees, and it was then difficult to establish who had been tampering with the laptop, where the information went, and how it was leaked out. This was a particular case in Spain where obviously the data privacy is very high, and you'll find that if you have a checklist and a system where you recover the information and the tools as soon as the employment contract is termination, you'll be much much better off. So I think it's now time to turn to China and get a bit more input from Wang Li. Thank you, Wang Li.
Thank you, Min. I think it's for those who attended last year's non-compete and trade secret law in China. We mentioned about that before 2013, there is no clear rule or law in relation to compensation or consideration for the non-compete obligation. So some cities or province impose 10% of the average salary. Some impose 50% of the average salary. Some events go up to 100% of the average salary. So it's very confusing. And if there's any company they operate in different city and province, they will encounter a very different rule. In July 2013, the Supreme Court of China issued a judicial interpretation where the standards of non-compete compensations are provided. According to the judicial interpretation, where the parties have a non-compete agreement without a compensation clause, 30% of the monthly average salaries of the employee must be withstand and paid, provided, of course, that employee has performed his or her non-compete obligation. However, if the compensation calculated above is lower than the local minimum salary, the local minimum salary standard should be applied and paid. What that means is, for those lower income owner, 30% of their average monthly average salary could be lower than the local minimum salary standard, then the local minimum salary standards should be applied. Now, there is different understanding regarding the judicial interpretation. One understanding is that the Supreme Court has set up a bottom line of a non-compete compensation, which means you can set up a compensation higher than that bottom line, but should not be lower than 30% of the average salary. So the party are not allowed to agree on the lower standard. Another understanding is that the bottom line only applies where there is no compensation clause. The party are free to agree on a lower standard. This year, there is a new case in Shanghai show that Shanghai court is more flexible and relaxed. They adopted the interpretation which allowed the lower compensation standard. In the case called Liu Ke versus Shanghai Zhongxin Software, the employer and employees agree 20% of the compensation in the non-compete agreement. The court ruled in favor of the company, so they upheld that lowest compensation is valid as long as both parties agree. However, in Shenzhen, the situation is quite different. The Shenzhen local authority set up a minimum compensation of 50% of the average salary. What they think is the Supreme Court, they set up the bottom line for the local authority. They are entitled, or they have authority to set up a standard higher than that. So in Shenzhen, the non-compete compensation is minimum 50%. So local regulation and the implementations of the Supreme Court's judicial rule is quite different. Employer in China should watch out for such variation in their own city or province to ensure compliance. There is also a couple of controversial issue in China, even after the Supreme Court judicial interpretation. The first is non-compete agreement without compensation clause valid? Because this is very often happen that there is a non-compete agreement, but without the clause provide the compensation. In some city in China, the court ruled that without compensation clause, the non-compete agreement is not valid. Like a Zhejiang province. However, in Shanghai, again, it is very relaxed. Shanghai court held the non-compete agreement without compensation clause is still effective. And then the Supreme Court 30% of the stand should apply. The other issue is, what are the implications for defaulted payment by employers? Because the Chinese judicial interpretation provide that employee may terminate the non-compete agreement if employer fail to pay non-compete compensation for the period of 3 months or longer. It is unclear what happens if within 3 months and the employee cannot trigger the right granted by the judicial interpretation, what happened. There is a lot of variations of different decision. So to avoid potential legal risk, employers are recommended to pay non-compete compensation in full and on time, unless the employer believe they don't need the employee to fulfill or perform its obligation, then notice should be issued to the employee. What should be the geographic scope for non-compete obligation? According to Chinese labor contract law, the geographic scope of non-compete obligation are to be agreed by the two parties. However, it is not clear whether a worldwide non-compete clause is effective in China. In fact, the local court in different city and different province hold different views. Employers are recommended to draft on a more specific, reasonable geographic scope in a non-compete agreement to make it enforceable, instead of just stick to the labor contract law, which said both parties may agree the geographic scope. Is compensation payable to employee employed by non-compete company? A simple answer is yes. Because if the employees perform its non-compete obligation and the employer pay for that obligation after the employment terminate and the ex-employee find a new job, unless the employer decided that it will not want to continue to get the employee to perform its non-compete obligation. All these should be made very clear. The next update is about the trade secret law. And also, I think it's in our last year's presentation, we mentioned about in China, it is very difficult to apply and be granted injunctive relief. And this is it's a big problem for China for many years. In 2013, there is a landmark cases, Alice Lilly's Code versus former employee. In that case, the Alice Lilly's Code and its Chinese subsidiary were granted an interruptive injunction over a former employee who had downloaded confidential documents and resigned. And this is the first time ever in China a court issue an injunctive relief. In 2014, there is a new case from the same court, the Novartis China versus her. In this case, the employee or ex-employee at a chemical department downloaded 879 documents containing trade secrets from the company's database, and he later joined a competing company. Novartis applied for an injunction, which was granted within 48 hours. The new development, as you know, this case compared with the last year's one, is in this case, the judge put specifically about the consideration factors. He listed 5 points, whether the applicants made out a prima facie case. 2, the potential threat of irreparable damage or injury to the petitioner. 3, balancing of the potential cost and harms of each party. 4, the urgencies of the petitions. And the last one is the public interest, which is really made this very clear stance compared with the last cases, and also make the injunction relatively clear and easy. However, there is no similar case has been reported from other courts in other cities, other provinces in China. So far, only Shanghai court last year, this year, had issued the injunctive relief. The uncertainty with the application of the Article 100 of the Civil Procedure Law, because there is the argument as to how to read this Article 100 of the Civil Procedure Law. Shanghai court, it's more flexible. I think this is should cover the protection of the trade secret. Some other court have a different view. So the uncertainty also is the standard of proof, whether the prima facie cases is enough, or you should, the applicant should prove that you are most likely to win the case on merit. There is a rumor saying that Supreme Court in China has been consulting with a foreign legal expert judge from American, Europe, Australian court, and gathering detailed information concerning the international best practice for injunctive relief, which suggests that a new judicial interpretation on preliminary injunction may be seriously considered and could be issued in the near future. I think this is the update of the Chinese part of the latest development in non-compete and trade secret law.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks, Wang Li. That's great. Very, very different law out there. Before we move on to Europe, I just wanted to read out the CLE code for this training. It's S for Sam, 0716. I'm going to repeat the CLE code for this training. S for Sam, 0716. So just moving on to Europe, as mentioned, we will be just gliding through these aspects just in the interest of time. What's the current protection for trade secrets in Europe is that there's been a UK decision earlier this year on whether the protection of trade secrets applied if it was inserted in the first agreement and it was continued, and whether it continued to apply in the second agreement. I think what was interesting in that decision, and there was a an alert from the firm in March, is that it is possible to have the covenant to on trade secrets apply in a second agreement, even though it wasn't reiterated. It's quite surprising in the UK, where the wording of the employment contract is usually quite important and is carefully considered by the court, and where, for example, there was a clause saying that all previous elements of the contract were superseded by the new new contract, but it is positive for employers. The situation in Europe generally is that there's a patchwork of protection. There's no uniform protection across the board. Well, you see the four boxes here summarize the various situations. France and Cyprus have their own rules, and then other countries like Austria, Bulgaria, Czech Republic, Estonia, Germany, Finland, Greece, Hungary, and many more have another set of rules, and other countries don't have any specific statutory provisions. And so it's important to understand that there is a patchwork of rules in Europe. There is, however, potential hope because there is a proposal of an EU directive for trade secret protection. Now, before you get too excited, I think it's important to let you know that it is only a proposal. It hasn't gone through the consultation process. There isn't any time for the text to be submitted to the Commission Council. So, and given that Europe is a bit in a state of flux at the moment with a lot of nationalist and independent movements, we're not entirely sure that this will directive ever come into force. If it were to be become a directive, it wouldn't be implemented in the various member states for another 2 years in any event. So we are at very early stages, but it's nevertheless important to mention it because what the directive tries to provide here is a common definition of trade secrets. At the moment, trade secrets have a different definition in each member state. So with a common definition, the idea is to have uniform rules about the acquisition, the use, and the disclosure of trade secrets. There's also a common set of procedures and remedies that are planned in the directive for trade secret holders. That, again, would ensure that there is a common view of how trade secrets should be treated across the EU. It's important to mention, however, that because it's a directive, each member state would be able to implement and, vary some of the clauses. It's quite common that some countries ask for an exemption from certain aspects of the directive. But again, we'll have to see how things develop. The UK feedback so far on the proposal is that the UK feels that they are already compliant with a lot of the proposals and that they have the adequate protection, so they wouldn't need to change their legislation. But I think really the conclusion is watch this spot and see what happens in the near future. Now, finally, moving on to the last aspect of the presentation, the top tips for multinational employers. We wanted to really summarize some of the key considerations, and Dan is going to give us the first flavor of what are those top tips for multinationals.
Well, thanks again, Ming. With so many different issues to consider, it's not surprising that these issues present such a potent challenge to multinational employers. Unfortunately, there are a lot of proactive steps that employers can take to maximize their ability to protect their assets. And you can see on the screen, we've listed a few pointers. And at risk of stating the obvious, that the first pointer I would suggest is that one size does not fit all. As a matter of necessity, most employers will have to operate off templates, as there's simply no way to efficiently recreate the wheel for each employee. It doesn't make sense to do that. But that doesn't mean that employers should be so wedded to their templates that they don't take an appropriate look at their agreements and make sure that they are varying them from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as needed, particularly where agreements are going to be used with employees in a variety of jurisdictions. It's always a good idea to draft to the highest standard to ensure the widest likelihood of enforceability across jurisdictions. A second pointer, again, perhaps obvious, but one that should be stated, is that you really awfully ought to carefully consider the logistics of rollout and consideration and make sure you know what the legal requirements are before you implement these kind of agreements. Can the agreements be rolled out to existing employees, or is this something that will simply be used on a going-forward basis with new employees? Regardless, what needs to be provided to the employees to ensure enforceability? Again, these considerations may vary considerably from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and knowledge on the local rules and procedures and practices are essential. You might also consider taking advantage of carrots and sticks that are available to you under whatever local rules you're operating under. For example, in executive benefit plans, it may be possible to include clawbacks and forfeiture of deferred compensation for breach of loyalty provisions. That's very common in the U.S. You might also consider use of garden leave provisions, depending on the jurisdiction that you're in. Both Ming and Justine talked about those types of provisions in the U.K. and in Australia. I think historically they have not been used very much in the U.S., but increasingly they are being used more often than not with employment executive agreements, and there are some benefits to having those in the agreement, provided that that's consistent with the local rules. A third pointer is to consider choice of law and forum selection language in the agreements. I talked earlier about how common these are in the U.S., and they are very important tools to consider any time you have a potential connection to U.S. courts. For example, a few years ago, a federal court in California decided an interesting case called Vance's Food, Inc. versus Special Diets Europe Limited that provides an interesting example of how forum selection clauses can be used in the international context. In that case, a California-based company sued an Irish company and its two principals, both of whom were residents of Ireland, for misappropriation of trade secrets and violations of an NDA that the California company had with the Irish company. Importantly, the contract at issue in that case had a California choice of law provision, though it did not have a forum selection clause. The Irish company and its principals argued in that case that they were not appropriately subject to the jurisdiction of the California court, and the California court disagreed and held that it could properly exercise jurisdiction over the Irish company and over at least one of the principals of the company who had been very involved in negotiating the contract. And among other facts, the court noted the existence of the California choice of law provision and reasoned that these defendants reasonably could anticipate having to defend a lawsuit in California. This is not an employment case, but the same principles apply in the employment context. If an agreement contains a mandatory choice of law and forum selection clause, an employer has a better shot of getting jurisdiction over a former employee who violates an NDA or a non-compete agreement, even if that employee is located in a foreign jurisdiction. Again, though, there's no guarantee these will always be enforceable, and you should certainly consult counsel knowledgeable on the local law, whatever jurisdiction you're operating in, knowing that in some places this approach is not going to fly. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Ming to discuss some additional practical tips.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, just very quickly on the other aspects of top tips for us to share with you. We mentioned briefly, I think it's very important to review and update the restrictions on promotions at the time of peer review or even at the time of an acquisition, so that you make sure that as the size of the company develops, as the career of the employer develops as well, that you are ensuring that your trade secrets are appropriately protected and that the non-compete are properly enforceable. It's quite a good practice to maybe do a review every year or every couple of years, depending on the cycles of your company. I mentioned earlier the exit interviews. I think it's worth emphasizing on that to say that it's important to make sure that the departing employees return all the equipment and that they have reminders of their obligations signed. So, for example, an acknowledgement or a declaration, depending on how that works in your country. I think that the last point is going to be on the prevention that Dan is now going to discuss very briefly.
Yeah, it's important to consider as appropriate and subject to whatever local privacy laws there are, conducting a forensic examination of an employee's computers, emails, devices, etc., at the time that the employee terminates their employment. There was an interesting article in the Boston Globe a few years back about a former Intel engineer that provides a good example of the importance of forensic examinations. The Boston Globe reported, and this was back in 2012, that this particular employee had accepted a job with a competitor, but told Intel that he planned to work for a hedge fund and wanted to take 2 weeks of vacation before his last day. And while he was still on Intel's payroll, the employee began working for a competitor and secretly downloaded manufacturing and design documents that were worth between $200 and $400 million. And I think in this case, the employee did not leave the jurisdiction, but you can imagine what an even bigger issue it would have been had the employee attempted to flee overseas. Fortunately, Intel did a routine review of the employee's email, and as a result of that examination, discovered what the employee had done. For the company, that was a happy ending. They were able to put a stop to the theft. Ultimately, the employee was sentenced to 3 years in prison for his theft. But this is a story in the news that it just demonstrates how important it can be to make sure that you're looking at what the employee's actions were and examining their computers and other devices, if local law allows that, and how important such a step can be to potentially avert disaster. Just a few other practical tips, and again, a lot of these are probably fairly obvious, but you want to make sure you store hard copies of documents in locked closets or drawers. You want to limit the ability of employees to print or remotely access sensitive documents. Limit access to the most important and most sensitive documents or other information to employees with a business need for access. I mentioned a minute ago forensic examinations. It's also appropriate or can be appropriate to monitor employees' use so long as that's consistent with local privacy law. And certainly in the U.S., you want to make sure you've got a very thoroughly and vigorously drafted IT use policy that ensures that employees are aware that they don't have a reasonable right to privacy or expectation of privacy as to their use of company devices. And then finally, it always makes sense to encrypt data, provide password protection on documents, install protective markings or use any other kind of technological devices available to protect your information so that it's not going to be easily misappropriated. And with that, I'll hand it back over to Ming.
Thank you, Dan. I think that that really summarizes a lot of the concept that we wanted to share with you today. If you are interested in having more information on trade secrets and non-compete consideration, please visit our blog, tradesecretslaw.com. It's an award-winning blog that is very successful and really gives you regular updates on these questions. We are probably going to be a bit short of time for questions, but you'll have the details of all the speakers for this webinar today. And what we would recommend is that if you have any questions, please contact us. And we'll be very happy to get back to you. And so thank you very much for your attention. And this finishes the session today.
Thank you. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.